Again, what you've been listening to is Paul McCartney. Give Ireland back to the Irish that he wrote, as I said earlier, 24 hours after Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland, where the English troops mowed down 14 unarmed Irish standing up for their independence. That happened just back in 1972. And part of what we're talking about, it fits that very well, is an issue of violence in our society and in our world. And whether we're looking at what just happened in Colombia, or whether we look at the what happened in Newtown, or we look at what happened in the streets of Baltimore, 22 people killed already in Baltimore City this year, 23 if you count the man killed by the police. If you talk about, there are at least 10,000 people under the age of 18 years old every year in the United States of America who are shot by weapons, by guns. When you were talking to earlier to Andre, our engineer, about how society has gotten violent, even in the ways who just left the studio here was Chauncey Whitehead. And Chauncey's a dear friend. He's also my trainer. He's also who I go out and box with. He's my boxing trainer at the moment. I was a boxer when I was young. And I say that only to say that I think of the world today, boxing was a tough sport. People got bloodied up.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough. But now we have MMA in our face every day, which is just a step above. And I have a nephew who was in MMA and left. It's a step above a street brawl. It's like gladiators in the ring. So there's something in our world, around us here, that is stoking violence among our kids and among our whole population, and that kind of envelops us. One last thing. There was a story yesterday that was very disturbing that came out of Prince George's County in a public school, where a young girl who was 7 years old was beaten unconscious by four boys in her gym class. When 75 kids were there and five teachers, nobody seemed to see it. But a seven-year-old girl beaten unconscious who had come home before. So something is going on, and I know that, as I said last time, one more thing is Bobby Marvin Holmes, my old producer, and I have been talking about this because he's been working with young people in the community a lot, and he thinks it's something that is very pervasive in our society. It's not just poverty. It's not just race. It's not just the inner city. It's something pervasive in our land about violence. Well, we are joined here with Dr. Lawrence Brown, who is a political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy here at Morgan State University. Good to have you back, Lawrence.
Morning. Good to be here. Good to
have you back in Baltimore from your break and vacation.
Indeed.
Michelle is with us, the IndyCom mom of comedy and former OSI Baltimore Community Fellow, founder of Gold Diggers, the Sankofa Project, working with young girls in the Park Heights community. And the Reverend Heber Brown, pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church and a leading community activist, are in the studio with us. Good to have you all here.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
And we want to hear what you think out there at 410-319-8888 about violence in our world and why we have become, it seems, almost the uber-violent society we're creating here. Is it more than we've ever had before? Are we just noticing because of the media? What's happening, do you think? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, or you can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We really want to hear what you have to say in this next hour, a bit more than an hour in this discussion. So good to have you all here. Lawrence, as I was speaking, you were just nodding your head. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking a lot of things. In particular, as a public health professional, I'm thinking about some of the science that we come across. There's a field called epigenetics, which looks at how genes are expressed, and the way that something that happens to somebody's parents or grandparents can be essentially passed on to their offspring. This happens not because the genes themselves are changed, but the way that they're expressed is changed, or the way that certain genes are turned on or turned off. And what this literature tells us is that if parents have experienced something traumatic, it can increase the stress response in their offspring, their children, and in their grandchildren. And so I wonder when you pose the quandary that we're dealing with today, we're talking about repeated exposure to violence throughout American history and the trauma that people are experiencing. And I don't think we often really look at how trauma and violence go together. You know, when we look at the history of serial killers, or we look at serial killers in the United States, many of them have a history of child abuse, neglect, some sort of serious trauma that's happened to them. And so it doesn't mean that everyone that goes through trauma, even PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, it doesn't mean that everyone that has trauma will turn out to be someone who engages in violence. But that trauma certainly does increase it, both in that person's lifetime, it increases the chances that they themselves will go and engage in violence, and victims of trauma pass on in an epigenetic way. They pass on a decreased ability to deal with stress, and perhaps that also means that people then will have a higher propensity to engage in violence as well.
What you're saying is a very critical piece, I think. And folks, we're calling, by the way, at 410-319-8888. Wayne in Westminster, hold on. As soon as I hear from these other panelists, we're going to come right to your call. So do not hang up. We want to hear what you have to say about guns, and then lead us out to part of this conversation. I think it's important. So please stay with us. But I think what you're saying about epigenetics is important, because this is a study. This is something that many people have been talking about for years, and science is finally getting to the point where we're researching it, which has to do with the effect of the environment on our genes and our behavior. And we don't, I think, understand that enough. Because it's, you know, yes, of course, we have all personal responsibility, and that's a piece of what we have to address in everybody's lives, and people taking responsibility, without a doubt. But the environmental factors on people's behavior, because is it normal for 4, 7, 8-year-old boys to beat unconscious a 7-year-old girl? I think that's not normal.
Obviously, I think it's not normal either. But I think when we do understand some of the environmental factors, when we do take an honest look at society and culture, in another way, it's quite normal. I mean, this is violence is an American way. you mentioned at the top about MMA. That's our entertainment. You go on Facebook any day of the week, somebody's posted some world star hip hop video of somebody getting knocked out, and it's getting forwarded and retweeted 20 and 25 times. We are entertained. Many of the best video games on Xbox and PS3, Call of Duty and all these games, these are violent war games. And so I think sometimes our surprise is surprising that we've created a climate and a culture where it's so acceptable that it's entertaining to us. It says that if that's the culture and that's the climate, then of course you're going to have these types of things happen. And no matter what suburb or city or culture or community or segment of the society, if that's what celebrated virtue and value, you're going to see it take expression in some kind of way.
That's a really critical piece. I think we need to explore in some depth, too, what you were saying as well just now, Heber. I mean, because there's always this debate about, and we're just outlining some ideas here, folks. We're going to kind of just delve into them a little bit more deeply. But there's always this debate about, is it the entertainment industry that's causing the violence among our youth? And I think that's too easy to say, and also too simplistic to say it doesn't have an effect. Of course it has an effect. And what the relationship is between our culture and society that it lets us explode. And it's like there's always been this kind of violent culture inside of America in many different ways, but it's also the technology that is allowing it to spread in ways that we can't control. The tweeting, the games that are being produced. My own grandsons, I watch, play these violent video games all the time. They're like, and when you watch them, they're like, they can't leave it. They're so stuck. They're sucked into it. It's like, you know, and they become in
almost
it.
Almost hypnotized by it, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well,
they laugh about violence. Mm-hmm. They laugh. And they're not mean kids. They're not violent kids. They don't go beating up people. But they laugh about the violence.
Mm-hmm. It's insidious, though, Mark. I think I'm gonna veggie back on what Heber said, because this country was created in violence. It's very difficult to even try to deconstruct that. But it is the reality. It was created in violence from the moment that your dear Christopher Columbus, so-called, discovered a place that was already existing. It was already a peaceful place with people who lived here for hundreds of years, and then it was taken over. So I think it perpetuated from the very onset. And then what happens is the violence becomes, you get desensitized. That's why your grandsons can look at that, because it's a part of the norm now. It's exactly what Heber said. It goes from history to real time, and then perpetuated in virtual time, and then perpetuated in the home, and then perpetuated in your community. And what you have is a climate set up for residual effects. And when you talk about the epi effects, the residual effects, Dr. Brown, of violence, and it becomes the norm. So much so that that's why it was radical for Dr. King to speak non-violence, because this was such a violent place. And so the very idea of non-violence is violent, because you're putting yourself in a violent situation and you're espousing that you will not be violent, which violates the violent people. So it's a cycle. It's a cycle of just, this is what it is. And now you kind of slid entertainment in. And I've got to speak because I'm an entertainer. And I'll tell you, even as a stand-up comic, I mean, I've just finished two television shows that are going to be out in the next couple of weeks. And comics are known for making light of beating your kids or beating somebody up, or it's a punchline now. You know, even violent situations in stand-up have become punchlines. Don't make me, they'll say a violent person from a reality show, don't make me so-and-so you. So if it's the girl from Basketball Wives who beats everybody's wife up, don't make me Evelyn you. You know, now it becomes an adjective to be violent, and they use it in punchlines and it gets a laugh. So yes, Mark, it is almost like there is no place to start or stop. But because I am a optimistic person, I believe that we can take some steps, and we can talk about that further along in the conversation.
I mean, yet there are a lot of studies. There are scientists like Steven Pinker and others who have been writing that violence has always been part of human culture, and that it's actually less prevalent in the 21st century than it was before.
Well, not only that, crime has gone down from its high point in the 70s and 80s during the crack cocaine epidemic. But yet, I think the way we're processing violence is different, given the rise of social media, the rise of 24/7 television and cable news. So the way I believe we're saturated with it, I think, and the way we process it is differently, and especially for children, again, because you talked about the video games. We can talk about children who play with cell phones and tablets. So they're exposed to a richer media environment almost from the get-go, and I don't believe we yet understand what is the effect on the human brain and the whole concept of violence when you're constantly saturated from it, when you can have it in your hand, have it on a tablet, have it on the screen, have it all around you through multiple venues in a much more realistic way. You know, you look at a movie like 12 Years a Slave. Well, that was a remake of a movie, Solomon Northrup's Journey. And if you compare the level of violence in 12 Years a Slave, what they do in that movie is much more realistic. I mean, the way they portray it through the cinematography, the way they're zooming in and out of beatings. So it's like a much more you are there experience, whereas in the past, I think violence in media was a bit more sanitized, a bit more deodorized. You know, it wasn't as realistic as we portray it in our media today. So I think that's something that we're just coming to grips with.
I don't know if I agree with that, but I will say this. You know, when I think about early films, when you talk about violence being a little more deodorized, I found nothing sanitized about Birth of a Nation. I think it was a horrific piece, you know. And so I think it's a matter of your thought process. That was a horrible, horrible piece, but it was saturated around the world. People saw it. The other thing, when you said that it's been, you know, tablets and things are in your hand, it goes back to the point of, you know, how can we monitor all of this media and all of this access? And I tell people all the time, it's not that I'm bragging, but 90% of this can be filtered at home. Well, 90% of it.
It can and it can't. I mean, I'm not sure it all can be filtered at home.
I'm saying in terms of your kids having access to certain, you know, filters of violence. I mean, you as a parent can decide you don't watch television during the weekday. That's something we've done for 12 years. I'm not saying that nonviolent, but I'm just saying just cut down on the access.
Well, I mean, I don't go to the phones here. I'm capable of jumping in. Is that the people are waiting to get in this conversation. But I mean, I think that the difference between like Birth of the Nation and what I think Lawrence is talking about is that the blood and gore, the literal blood and gore, right, is in your face in film now all the time. And people go to see movies for the blood and gore, to watch people bleed and be hurt. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. And also
the cinematography. I'm not saying, certainly, Birth of a Nation, very violent, and I agree with you there, absolutely. But I'm saying, it was black and white. Mm. Films today are in color.
Oh, right.
I mean, the realistic portrayal and the you are there experience that we get from today's cinematography, I think, provides much more of an immersive experience with violence. And mm-hmm. that's really what I'm like, aiming
Cowboys and
for
gangsters
there.
Didn't have blood flowing when they died in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s in the movie. Because that had its own issues, but even on the way to the phones.
Yeah, I think Michelle makes a great point about parenting. I put the question out yesterday about, you know, I said, I'm coming on the air, and I asked folks, you know, what are we missing? You know, what has not been said? We talk about violence a lot in Baltimore. What have not been said? A lot of people on Facebook and Twitter, we're talking about family. We're talking about the home. And there's an Ashanti proverb that says that the ruin of a nation begins in the homes of its people. And so that point about what we can't control in the home, I think, is well taken. And really, I think it's also a nod. I mean, just in a matter of about maybe 10 minutes, we've gone from cinematography to the family, entertainment. I think it's a nod to the complexity of the issue. And I think sometimes we are so baptized in violence, if I can use that phrase, in this culture, that it can seem overwhelming. It can seem just so gargantuan that we can't even deal with it, right? And so I think sometimes it's important for us to get some focus. We can't do something about every single thing. What can we do? I mean, and that's what I hope, and I'm sure we'll get to as the conversation goes on.
We will.
What is the manageable things that each one of us can do to, you know, throw our pebble on the mountain of peace to help the China change the culture?
Mm. And what do you think? 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Wayne in Westminster, you're on the air.
How do you do? Yeah, I'd just like to first say, guns don't kill people. People with guns kill people. The more people that have guns, the more people are going to die. And guns are indiscriminate. They will kill your children, your mother, your father, your grandparents, your neighbor. They don't care. And the more we flood our communities with guns, the more people are going to die. And another thing is these automatic weapons, these semi-automatic weapons, where all you have to do is pull the trigger, and another round is fired. Is insane. I mean, at least put weapons, if you're going to put weapons on the street, make you have to cock it in between rounds so people have a chance, give you a chance to think about what you're doing. I mean, thank God the kid at the mall the other day only had a shotgun where he had to cock it in between rounds, gave people a chance to get away. And actually probably give him chance to think about what he was doing. Unfortunately, he took his own life, but at least he didn't kill more than the people he did. And it seems to be a factor. Suppose he had a semi-automatic gun, a Glock or a AR-15 or a AK-47, what the body count would have been then?
Wayne, thank you so much. I mean, and this is part of the argument, but guns is a factor in violence in our society, the accessibility of guns. And I'm always getting torn between the idea of people's right to own a weapon and not being told what they can and cannot own, and the question of the role that guns and the gun industry plays in all of this.
I have so many mixed feelings about guns. I just do. I don't own one, but there is... It's almost a romantic notion now. I mean, there are friends of mine who we've had conversations about going to the gun range and learning how to use a gun. But you know, I have such mixed emotions. While everything that Wayne said was valid in his own right, that was a point that I would have never even mustered the gusto to say, at least between the cock, you have a moment, and forgive me for saying that, but cocking the gun, you have a moment to think about it. I would have never even thought about that, but there is a reality to that. That automatic weapon piece, it's all so convoluted because you think about, this is the country where we have the right to bear arms, but at the same time, who is that right given to, and how qualified? Like, what is the, there's one of the big discussions is what qualifies you to have the right to bear arms? I mean, clearly, everybody is not qualified to bear arms. And so I just have very mixed feelings about guns, and it just makes me think more about it.
I'll let you come back. I'm just going to take a quick break, and you come back with your thought of 410-319-8888. We have a whole another hour more to get in this conversation, so hang on with us. You're going to get in, Peggy, Gary, Dave, who called in. We're going to get to your calls. And we're going out with Natural Woman. This is the birthday of Carole. This is the day in 1971 that Tapestry came out, one of the best albums ever made, I think, by Carole King. She's one of the great soul writers of our country and some of the songwriters. This is Natural Woman.
But I won't be blue always. You know the sun gonna shine.
The great Lightnin' Hopkins died on this day in 1982, born in 1912, one of our great blues musicians. Share that a little bit. That'll all be on our website. You can kind of hear more of him and all the other songs that we're doing today. We are here with Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. Michelle, the indie comedy of Mom, who works with children as a former OSI Baltimore Community Fellow and founder of Gold Diggers at the Sankofa Project, as she works her heart out over in Park Heights with these young girls. Reverend Heber Brown, pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, community activist, one of our leading community activists in the city, who doesn't always swim in the mainstream, but has said what has to be said, and is working diligently to get his PhD right now. Glad he had time to join us in the studio.
Thanks for the invitation.
410.
Good to get away from the books for a minute, Mark.
410-319-8888 is the number. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner. Go on our Facebook pages, which I'll look at in just a moment. But, Lawrence, you were about to say something.
Well, you know, before we went to break, we were talking about the qualification to carry a gun. And I think that does bring up a serious conversation about mental health. But I think the discussion about mental health needs to be broader than it currently is. When we look at the statistics in this country, nearly 90% of homicides are committed by men. And an overwhelming supermajority, nearly 100% of serial killings and mass killings are committed by men. And so What is it that, I mean, the guns are there for women, the access, the video games, a lot of these things are there in our society, in our culture, but there's something about masculinity, traditional masculinity especially, that I think we need to hone in on. And specifically, I think traditional masculinity is grounded in concepts of power and war. When we think about traditional masculinity, we are socialized as boys to be protectors, providers, and breadwinners. And I think when men are unable to fulfill that traditional masculine role, those who hold to traditional masculine norms, there are multiple masculinities, but for those who hold to traditional masculine norms and they're unable to fulfill that norm, I believe that constitutes and induces a crisis of epic proportions. Let me tell you, when I was depressed last year, a little over a year ago, as I was transitioning into the job that I have now as assistant professor. And I was depressed because I wasn't getting a paycheck at the time. I felt stressed out from trying to meet all of my obligations as a community activist and working here and there. And in that moment of stress, in that moment of depression, I felt a certain lethargy and lack of energy, but I also felt that a more of a violent impulse. I felt like I could become angrier a lot quicker. And even now I find that, you know, I go to the gym, I work out, I lift weights and everything. But if I'm driving and somebody cuts me off, man, I'm ready. I'm ready to throw down. I'm ready to cut somebody out. You know, masculinity is about, I'm trying to uphold my image as a man in society, but I have when I'm able to calm down and think about it, I have certain things that I can fall back on and say, you know what, I'm doing all right. But for those guys that don't have anything to fall back on, if we're not surrounding them with mental health and help around what's going on inside their head, then I think we'll see a lot more of this, because we're really not getting to the mental health root, which is really around masculinity and the way we frame masculinity around power.
So, but let me jump in, let you jump in here. The question, I have a question. Let you jump in, then I'll do my question. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, let me just say, I agree, and I push back a little bit too, because there's a sliver of possibility there when you talk about traditional male roles, right? And how that, I would push back and say that is, if you're talking about Western Euro models of manhood.
And I am.
then you're exactly right. I mean, I think that goes back to Michelle's piece as well about Christopher Columbus. I mean, we have a Mount Rushmore. We got a mountain with people's faces on it that glorify their war exploits and et cetera, et cetera. But I think there is something there that if we can look at different models of manhood, and I think particularly for black men, if we're talking black men now, that there are other models, there are other patterns outside of this context that I think would serve us well and probably are more compatible to our heritage and culture as well, that we can kind of plug in back to who God wired us to be, and it'd be a little bit different.
And I agree with that, but I would also say, you know, white men especially need a new model of manhood, because their manhood has been predicated upon.
Well, yeah, and if we're taking our cues from white men in terms of what it means to be a man, then all of us are messed up. So,
absolutely.
Let me push back a little bit on that. Then we'll open the phones here again.
Sure.
Because I think some of what you're saying, I don't disagree with at all, Heber. Yeah. I mean, and what you're saying, Lawrence, I think is vastly interesting as well about the whole nature of masculinity in human culture and what it means to be a man. But the violence, the mass violence that took place in European wars, one can't argue about that existed. But I would push back and say that mass violence took place everywhere. That the violence in tribal nations, whether they be European tribal nations or native tribal nations here or nations in the continent of Africa, were just as violent between cultures. And I think we make a mistake by thinking that they weren't. And I think that, you know, we like hold up somebody like Chaka Zulu, who was a brilliant military leader.
Mm-hmm.
But the atrocities he committed among anybody who got in his way and on the women around him, that was part of the divide between Mandela and Buthelezi, was that whole nature of what masculinity meant in cultures inside the continent itself. So I'm saying I think that there is something, I think, you know, that is rooted deeply inside of the male domination of culture, period, that has to do with why violence is so prevalent.
I think the tools, though, just real quick, I think of course, I'm in thesis mode. I'm in kind of study mode, right?
Yeah, don't go there, Heber.
Everything coming out of me is like some book from somewhere.
That's okay.
I'll say that from my studies, it appears that other cultures, not just African, but that's where the bulk of my study is,
right.
That there are greater tools available to engage, and there are other values that were lifted and reinforced by society. For instance, talk around the ancestors in African traditional religion, right? The ancestors speaks to the continuation of life, and the ancestors helped to uphold certain virtues and values of society that were reinforceable by the community, right? And so I don't see the same here. The ancestors, quote unquote, that are lifted in American culture, like I said, the military leaders and so I'm not saying that there wasn't ever bloodshed on the continent. I'm saying that I see not just in African culture, perhaps even in native cultures, indigenous cultures, that there was greater use of tools, there's greater treasure of tools available to engage some of these issues in a way that said, this is the standard, this is not.
I just want to jump in real quick before you guys take it any further. I think, Mark, what you said was interesting in that there has always been some perpetuation of violence inside of cultures. Like when you talked about Shaka Zulu, and then you segue to the difference between him and Mandela and his leader. But the thing I think that nobody's really speaking to is, think about those kinds of violences, and I'm not condoning any of it, were concentrated violence. There was a beginning, middle, and end, so to speak. I know that sounds horrid, but we're talking about violence now that has no beginning, middle, or end. It seeps cross-culturally. It seeps cross-economic statuses. Now the violence that we see that's so pervasive can happen anywhere at any time. There is no objective. There is no real reason why we're doing this. Shaka Zulu had a idea. He had a goal in mind. I'm not condoning his goal.
Well, I think he's also out of his mind. But anyway.
But so was Idi Amin. So we can talk about, you know, and it goes back to power when Lawrence talked about power. Because my daughter and son had a discussion 2 days ago. They're 12 and 7. Would you rather have power or would you rather have money? And I thought it was interesting that they both decided that they would rather have power. And so, you know, it's about that power thing. And I think when we think about violence and power, it's power begets violence, begets violence, begets power. I just think we just need to look at the fact that now violence has no schism. It's all across the board. There is no beginning. There's no middle. And there's no end. I just wanted to put that out there.
And I think that let's go to the phones here. But I want to kind of really I think it behooves us also to explore the whole question of masculinity in our culture and misogyny in our culture
and
rape in the world as a way to keep women controlled and violence at the root of that. And so if that's true, if that has run its way through society, human society in many ways, at different ways, how do we address that? How do we build a new – can we build a world that is different than that?
We have to. We can't afford not to.
But if we are going to create solutions, we have to understand the problem. You can't operate on cancer and not understand how cancer works. And so I think that, again, statistically, when we look at 90% of homicides being committed by men, right? And I haven't heard of a female mass killer yet, right? Outside of maybe Andrea Yates or someone who's killed their own children. But going into a mall shooting people, I haven't heard of a female mass killer yet. So there's something about masculinity that we really need to hone in on. I think we're afraid to do it as men. It's just like with race, you know, a lot of white people are afraid of talking about race. A lot of men are afraid of talking about masculinity. And what does that mean in terms of the construct of power? Again, when you don't have any power and the vulnerability that we feel, that we experience, we don't have the outlets that women have. The women are socialized to have to talk to each other, to create these networks where they're able to express what's going on.
I was going to negate
that. I think as men, we're very – I think, well, we don't have a culture that –
It's not learned behavior. It's not learned behavior.
That's what I was about to say. Right. It's not – we're not socialized to do that.
Yeah, it's not learned behavior. But in today's time, there's really no excuse for men not to exercise the ability to have an outlet because it's all over the place. Men are all together now having conversations. There's people who are putting it on national platforms. When Oprah gives Dr. Phil the opportunity to say, how is
Dr.
that working?
No.
Listen, Mark, I'm not pro Dr. Phil or against him. I'm just suggesting to put a man, a white man, on national television and say, how is that working out for you? How does that feel? That's the epitome of the white man masculinity piece being defunct. It's defunct because he's actually talking about feelings when typically all they care about is power and money and access.
Well, for me, it goes back to culture then.
Because
there's something that carries these values forward. And so for me, I'm studying different cultures to say this is not the universe, even though it's propped up as the universal example for everybody around the globe. There are other cultures that do it differently that do not experience these types of symptoms, because we're talking symptoms. And we would do ourselves well to study other cultures.
Absolutely.
And the Western Euro culture, I mean, no other culture on the globe. You're talking about spreading? You're talking about European hegemony? Mm-hmm. You're talking about sending ships? The sun never sets on the British Empire? There's a legacy and a lineage to this culture, and I think other cultures are healthier for us as a whole.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with that as a person who loves and understands, you know, the importance of culture, but I do think we have to highlight masculinity. Masculinity is propagated by culture.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
But I think to Mark's point, you're right. I mean, violence is as much a part of the human experience as dying and giving birth is. I mean, it's all over. Indigenous people, people in Africa, people in Asia, people in Europe have all committed tremendous atrocities against each other and against other people.
Agreed.
So this is, I mean, masculinity then I think it becomes something that's a global, when we talk about traditional masculinity, is something that I think is more of a global construct that we need to examine. And then we should examine how it intersects with culture, how it intersects with race, how it intersects with different societies that we live in. Class. But there is something central
but if it's
to
a global,
masculinity.
If it's a global construct, why don't we see the same numbers? For instance, in Ghana,
absolutely,
we don't see. So you're right. We got to talk about for the
Rwanda.
Past 2 weeks. But for the past 2 weeks, we've had these sessions at Pleasant Hope, our church, about sex trafficking, domestic violence, and sexual assault. And I was one of a very small handful of brothers who was able to make it to one of the two sessions. And I got an education. I mean, of course, there's an intellectual knowledge that, yes, this is bad. But I got a show enough education from these sisters who not only shared their powerful and courageous testimonies of being sexually abused many times by people that they knew and trusted, but also by the prevalence of it. Right. And so in terms of just really, really getting an education on many of the things that you're saying, you're exactly right. We got to deal with the fact that with the Super Bowl comes sex trafficking. And New York is about, I mean, that travels. Sex trafficking and human trafficking travels with the Super Bowl wherever it goes. So we do have to talk about those things. But if you call it masculinity a global construct, right, we should be able to see the very same patterns in East Baltimore that we see in Kumasi in Ghana. And we just don't. Not on that. We just don't see it. Just in the same way, for instance, we talk about health, physical health. You don't see the same levels of cancer in places like China that you see here. And so I think we got to examine that. Why are those differences in place, and what is it about those cultures that lift up certain values? I'm not saying it doesn't happen at all.
Has to be a value. I had to just jump in. There has to be a value placed on seeing those things in other cultures. I mean, you look at Polynesia or some of the, you know, Mediterranean cultures. You look at some of the cultures that are, you know, sustained by just the value of the water around them. And you just look at the simplistic lifestyles. That's not valued on the American continent.
Exactly.
It's actually demeaned. It's like, oh, these primitive people, but they have less cancer. They have less obesity. They have less domestic violence. And so you have to add a value. If there is no equity in that, then studying that is really for naught, because you're not going to transfer it over into your culture here. Mm. And so for me, it's really like, cut the narcissism. There's a level of narcissism as people from this particular part of the world that we won't even value what's working for you because it doesn't line up with our technology. It doesn't line up with our thought process. It doesn't line up with our ideas. It's demeaned.
We've lost a lot of callers. I promise people get to them. We haven't gotten to them.
Sorry.
Let me jump into this. Gary, I'm sorry you want to call back. We get you a call. The others who left us. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And so if you're out there, call back. We get right to your calls. Dave on Route 40, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning,
and your
Dave.
Host.
Good morning.
2 points. I have two quick points. I hope I can get everything out. When I called in, the person on the answer phone asked me where I was going to go. So culture, but I want to direct this more to the children, because we got to remember you can measure the strength of your society by how you take care of your kids, the adults, and the animals. So let's talk. I'm directing this to the children. When America was created, the people that were here were prevented or stopped from executing their culture. When the African was brought here, the first thing that was done to them, they had to stop being allowed to be African. America is 238 years old this July. There's a movie called Charlotte's Web where the little pig was trying to be like everybody on the farm. He was trying to be like the ducks, the horses, the cows, and they were joking him and playing him. The spider, which was Charlotte, which is a symbol of wisdom, always has been, said to the pig, why don't you try acting like a pig? And as soon as, I think his name was Wilbur, I can't remember. As soon as the pig started acting like a pig, doing pig things, responding to the actions on the farm as a pig, all the other animals on the farm embraced him. America, whatever the culture of America is, it's only 238 years old, give or take. But if you want the symptoms that it's affecting us and all of the other people that make up America, you have to go back to your culture. And like the female host said, the value, of course, has to be identified. But if you're not going to live out your culture, then the only other choice you have is to assimilate to something foreign. And then when the female host made a mention about arms, the right to bear arms. The right to bear arms was a provision placed in the Articles of Confederation. Oh, this is going back to like sixth grade history. It was a provision put in not to hunt, but to protect the colonies from tyranny. So when people run around talking about I got the right to bear arms, are you standing and being aligned to defend the country from tyranny, or are you just using that as the excuse to walk with a weapon? So it's like you said, other cultures, if the longer you hold on to your source, you know, the further you get away from the campfire, the colder you get. If the African in America can go back to their culture, which was, they would, you know, you have to de-Americanize yourself for a minute, Africanize yourself, and then start walking forward so you can play with the other kids in the playpen. So it's not just talking about culture. Your ancestral connection to life, like your umbilical cord, has to be re-engaged. If we do not do that, I'm talking to Asians, Boricuas, Africans.
Okay, Dave, go ahead. Let me ask you to finish up.
Okay, so that the gist of it is the right to bear arms has nothing to do with I can go get a gun. It's to prevent. It was a provision put in to prevent the country from falling into tyranny from inside. And culture, like the movie Charlotte's Web, and that's for the children to see, look at what Wilbur, when Wilbur embraced his culture, it prevented him from being turned into bacon. And that's all I had to say. You guys have a good day.
Thanks, Dave. There are a lot of arguments over what the Second Amendment came from, I think, that, and one of those arguments is also that it came up from the Southern militias, and their job was to keep slavery in check, and that's part of where the Second Amendment was born as well, because they wanted to keep their own militias to make sure that they kept their slavocracy in check in the South. That was another piece of where I think they came from. And I think that should we get another call in here and come right back to you all? 410-319-8888. Calvin, you're on the air.
I mean, we need to keep spreading the word. All the guests and the callers, they've been touching upon everything that's going on. My thing is, you know, if you got a violent society and then you arm them, this is the results. I'm going to say this one last thing that Dr. Martin Luther King said, because we have to, together, have to fix this thing. That is, he said, if mankind doesn't put an end to violence, violence will one day put an end to mankind. Because not only do they have guns everywhere, they have bombs everywhere, nuclear bombs everywhere. So it's a recipe for disaster. So each one of us got to do our part. We got to fix this thing. If we don't, it will fix us. Thank you.
And one of the things that, and let's try to get one more call in here. Kevin in Bowie, Maryland, and then we'll come back and get our conversation rolling back in here. Kevin, you're on the air.
Okay, thank God I'm off. I get to hear your show, Mark. Hey, I'm going to be real brief.
All right, thank you.
Shout out to Heber Brown also. But look. I'm going to be real quick. Two things I want to touch on real fast. Number one, violence is not I've traveled the world enough to see that violence is not exclusive to any particular culture or race, and that's unfortunate. I happen to, you know, I had a preconceived idea about, I had a chance to go to China, and I was surprised at how much, you know, street level, I mean, just grotesque type violence that occurs that maybe they may cover up, but I mean, it's unbelievable. Some of the violence. They may not be involving weapons, baseball bats or whatever else. There was a lot of, I was just surprised because I had this notion about the Asian culture. But I just want to touch on this thing in America. You know, there's just not a lot of outlets for, and I'm talking about young black men in particular, and I'm talking about street level violence. You know, not a lot of outlets for us when I see that there are a lot of the sisters, you know, who, there are a lot of things for the sisters to get involved in, a lot of women's groups at the churches. It's like, the black man's being pretty much pushed out of the church almost. You know, it's women in power, women this, women that, women financial groups and church and stuff like that. And nothing's being done for the men. And that's why a lot of our young black men are going towards Islam now, because they feel more as a man, a masculine person that's looking for some type of balance in their life. They're going to Islam, you know, because they feel more welcome there. But I think, you know, when we look at what's going on in the streets of Baltimore, you know, the outlet for our men, it's like a demasculinity of the man to become some type of new type of man that's contrary to what we are. And you see, that's why you see a lot of this violence and stuff, and that's one of the reasons I believe you see. But violence comes in all levels, intellectual, financial, physical. I mean, that's just something that occurs. It's predator and prey, I mean, on whatever level it is, and that's just how human nature is. So.
All right, Kevin, thank you so much. So we have we're just going to break. We'll come back and conclude this conversation with our three guests here and their thoughts and what our caller said and where we are. Stay with us. We'll be right back to continue our conversation on violence, why it's so prevalent and overbearing presence in our society with Dr. Lawrence Brown, the Reverend Heber Brown, and Michelle. Stay with us. Thank you. Once again, this is the birthday of Ahmed Abdul-Malik, and that is Maghreb, one of his great pieces, a man who knew, understood how to take music from cultures across the globe and incorporate them into the world of jazz and more, one of our great artists who died in 1993. Before that, we came on out, we heard Professor Longhair Tipitina. It is his birthday, and Professor Longhair is one of the, he really helped define New Orleans music, and play a bit more of him maybe on the way out. But let's come back to our guests here, and it's such an intense conversation. Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health, here in the community, School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. Michelle, the indie mom of comedy, former OSI fellow who's founder of Gold Diggers, the Sankofa Project, and the Reverend Heber Brown, pastor of Mount Pleasant, at Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, and community activist. 410. Well, let's, before we go back to the phones, let's come a comment. You were about to say something, Lawrence.
Well, I wanted to comment on what Kevin was saying, our last caller. He was speaking, I believe, to this notion that among many men that traditional masculinity is under attack. Now, to talk about traditional masculinity, or when I talk about it, I'm not saying this is the way things should be. I'm not defending traditional masculinity as the model of manhood that we should have. But for those who do hold on to it, I think many of them feel like there's less and less of a place for men in our society. You look at the Arab Spring. A lot of that took off because a lot of men were feeling they were unemployed. They weren't able to marry at an appropriate time and have children the way their culture mandates. And revolution ensued. You look at America, this great recession that we just experienced, it disproportionately affected men. When you talk about post-industrialization going back to the 70s, deindustrialization, the loss of manufacturing, you know, jobs that a lot of men were able to have to support their family, didn't need a college education, those jobs are by and large gone. And so, and The Wire illustrates this, I think, very in a very profound way, both for black and white people, the unions in season two. And so what happens to men when they're not able to fulfill, again, these traditional masculine norms? I think what it means is that we need to create a new form of masculinity that allows us to have some measure to protect our ego, because that's a big part of what I think traditional manhood is all about. But at the same time, is about justice, respect, gentleness, equity, and making sure that we're not lashing out whenever our power needs are not satisfied. And so I think that's what's very profound to me about what he was saying, is that there's this sense that we don't know what to do with masculinity today, because there are multiple masculinities, and the definition of masculinity is shifting and changing.
Heber, you're about to say what?
Yeah, I appreciate how the discussion has broadened, because I think in Baltimore we tend to just focus on guns when we talk about violence. So I do appreciate how we're broadened talking about masculinity now. And I will add and say that I agree with you when you say that other norms are necessary. All I'm saying is other norms exist. And that as we study other norms and other models of manhood, that we might possibly find some examples that we can incorporate, and then we have to work very hard to kind of incorporate these new models. Let me also say very quickly that, unfortunately, American culture is exportable as it relates to violence, and so I think we do well. When we see patterns engaging around the world where that looks like something that happened in Detroit, think about the way that American culture is exportable. And so you can go to places and, you know, different places and see a McDonald's or a kid. So if you know that the food and the clothes is going around the world, might it also be a possibility that our understanding, at least the American understanding of interpersonal relations, is also going around the world? And even going against some of the values, as we talked offline about Ubuntu, right? That's a concept and principle that is found throughout the African continent. Well, the American culture has no room for Ubuntu. I can't tie my identity up in my connection to you, because this culture says it's me, myself, and I. It's dog eat dog. It's whatever you got to do to get to the top. As that culture is exported across the world, as that American value is exported, we're going to see more and more examples and duplications of this perverted notion of interpersonal relationships around the world, in my opinion.
I just think I'm appreciating hearing men talk about a need for a new normal when it comes to the idea and the notion of what masculinity is. My challenge to everybody who's listening, my challenge to men in so-called leadership positions, because I use leadership relatively. I think you can lead from the rear, the middle, or the front. Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes men find leadership to be, you have to be out front, you have to be behind a podium. Mm. There has to be someone following you. And I'm in a different mode. I believe you can lead and there's no one there. But ostensibly, somebody's going to catch the leadership trend. I think for me, as a woman who you know, works with girls on a weekly basis and has written books for girls and currently is, you know, formulating the curriculum for girls, I think we have to give ourselves the opportunity to own the fact that we actually have some power. Not in the sense that we need to overpower you, but I think oftentimes we are so wrapped in making our man feel like he is secure and that he is powerful and that he is adored, when I think that should be something right. That should be earned. You know, that shouldn't be just, you know, men just show up and you are expected to be respected and treated well. Well, you've done nothing to earn that space. And I think that, you know, that quiet entitlement is old. It doesn't work anymore. It doesn't serve us. And then it repeats itself because you have all these guys who've done nothing to earn what I would call manhood, and they're expecting you to treat them like a man. I need you to show up first. And if you don't know how to show up, there needs to be spaces where we can have those kinds of, you know, let's unlearn the behavior that's not working, and let's learn some new behavior, and let's make it a ritual. Let's not make it a one-time thing. Yeah. Let's make it a ritual where this has to happen in order for you to get the place that you see for yourselves as a husband, as a pastor, as a talk show host. Who says you get to do that? You've done nothing to earn that. So for me, I need to see some changes made on a very ritualistic basis.
On the way back to phones, let me suggest something and see what you all think about this and what you all three were just saying, that in cultures before kind of capitalism took over the globe.
Can you find one? Can you find one?
I can find a couple.
No, I'm joking.
But in those cultures, you were saying Hebrew American, I would kind of expand that out to the last 500 years and capitalist culture on the planet and its power on the globe and how it has kind of changed the nature of things, mm-hmm. and violence that comes out of that because it has to do with conquering and destroying and owning and digging up the earth and whatever else we can talk about. But there was in other cultures, masculinity did mean war sometimes, but it also meant hunting. It meant men wrestling. It meant being a provider for the family.
Nurturing.
Nurturing. Say that.
Holding children, being part of lives.
Absolutely.
Young men naturally are going to buck up against older people, because that's what young people do. Is you get that testosterone, you're coming up, you're going to buck up. But there was a culture that kind of said, okay, we're going to channel this buck upness into a right. different way to help you into manhood.
Rites of passage.
Right? We've lost all of that. I think, you know, I think about it. My sister lives in rural West Virginia, up in the mountains, by herself. She's a mountain woman. I love her. She's one of the smartest people I know.
Is that the one that says cool beans?
She says cool beans.
That's
yes.
my girl.
And so, but which the little country store down where near where she lives, there's a sign on this country store, and it says, "If you don't go a hunting with your son,
you won't eat.
You're gonna go a hunting for your son."
Mm. Mm.
Wow.
It stuck with me for the last 30, 40 years since I first saw that sign on that place in my sister's place. Because to me, it took it away from the whole gun debate, should you have them, should you not have them. It really is about culture. It really is about being part of a community, about how you take care of each other, what you do. And so, you know, if we still had, you know, whether it was the wrestling matches that took place in indigenous native cultures and the hunting, you know, the Maasai having to go down and face a lion mm-hmm. as part of the culture of coming up, whatever that meant. And that is part of, like, our masculinity problem. We have nowhere to let it out. So this culture, we let it out with this violence that also consumes us, whether it's video games or this MMA. You know, I just love watching MMA. I still watch it once in a while, but I go, God, man, this is like, you know, it's like the worst bar fight I ever saw. And it's not
Not healthy.
Mark, you
it's
said,
not healthy.
You said something so poignant. I don't even know if you heard yourself, but you said that there was an idea that a part of being a man was to provide. And that sounds so basic.
Right.
But let me just tell you now, there are tons of millennials and so-called the new normal kind of men who actually get agitated when they're the sole provider. They actually take issue with, I'm providing. You're not doing anything special. This is exactly what hundreds and thousands of men have done for millions of years, and they took value in that. So when you have a woman, and here's the challenge. Mm-hmm. So now, because women are providers as well, they think, well, you know, we don't have to provide anymore. Yeah, I think it's still a beautiful thing to show your son, to show those boys watching you that I enjoy taking care of my wife. I think it's a gift to take care of my children. But there are men who will get frustrated with the notion that I provide. And you said something, Mark, and it's so poignant. I want people listening today, there is nothing wrong with providing. There's nothing wrong with it at all. It is a beautiful, old-fashioned, new-fashioned, fierce way of living. And let me tell you something. You will get all kinds of admiration, all kinds of respect, all kinds of just allotment just because you enjoy the notion of being able to provide.
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with providing, but it becomes something... it becomes challenging when men aren't able to.
No, absolutely, and I get that. And that,
right.
You said that earlier because you got depressed, and
right,
I get
because
that.
Because you look at Baltimore, for instance, it's lost between 1950 and 2000, it lost 100,000 manufacturing jobs.
Right.
Good-paying
right?
jobs.
Good-paying jobs.
Good
and those jobs.
Jobs
still have not come back, and they probably won't be.
Right.
That's a reality we have to deal with. It's not just when you build an economy, you need to build an economy that's going to serve the needs, hopefully, of all sectors of the economy. And right now we have an economy, it's a service-based, knowledge-based economy that values people who have college degrees. But if you're a man without a college degree, if you don't have like some sort of vocational training of some sort, then this economy is not built to encompass that population. And what I'm saying is that I think as a society, we're not thinking deeply enough about the impact of deindustrialization on our men, the impact of this Great Recession, where a disproportionate number of men lost jobs. And we're not thinking, I think, deeply enough about the way that as men, I think we do need to understand and look at different ways, the rites of passage, you know, how do we socialize our boys in a very intentional way?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I think socialization is happening in a very random way. You know, we're learning from TV, we're learning from movies, mm-hmm. you know, and that's where we're getting our cues from. But what do we need to do to bring take our boys aside and then inculcate within them a way of thinking and a way of being that respects multiple masculinities,
mm-hmm.
multiple sexualities,
mm-hmm.
Multiple genders, but at the same time can protect those who still want to uphold traditional masculine norms? And as a straight male who wants to do that, I'm still trying to figure this out.
Final thought from you before we
final thought here. Solutions, right? We are not totally hopeless in all of this. There are so many groups and people out there who are creating important oasis in sanctuary all across our community. And so I just want to give praise to so many. I dare not say a name. Baltimore is too small. I will get hate mail. But there are so many groups.
Somebody out, right?
There's
yeah,
so many
start.
Organizations that are doing it. I will say what I'm doing, and I charge and challenge. Michelle is working with her program. Everybody's doing something,
mm-hmm.
right? And so a part of focus of my work right now, I've created an African-centered church school curriculum that I pray will be in as many black churches in the country as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is a rites of passage program. It takes the Sunday school model and pushes reset. I want to transform Sunday schools into freedom schools. It helps to do the same thing
Absolutely.
That you're talking about in terms of grooming up responsible, sober, sane, conscious, loving men and women in these special circles, because the churches and faith community has a role as well. So everybody can do something. Find your passion, find your place.
And to that end, I'm going to keep you laughing. I'm going to make sure you're laughing. That has to happen. And if you're around this weekend, I'm at the JCC in Owings Mills at the Gordon Performing Arts Center. One show only, guys. I'm going to make some of this violence go away by making you laugh before you punch somebody in the face. Hope to see you this Saturday.
So I just want to say, I think this has been a great discussion. And I think it's important for us to have these discussions with our community here on the air and other places that actually go beyond just the simple notions of violence in the inner city streets. Yes, I'm pro-gun, I'm anti-gun. I think it's a lot deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the kind of, we have to start thinking in those ways rather than the simplistic ideological liberal conservative notions that it's way beyond all of that in terms of figuring out what is with this world we have and how we can change it. And I think we have to have that. And I want to thank the three of you really for taking your time today. It's been a long discussion we've had, and appreciate you, the three of you, and the work that you do for this community. Michelle, it's always great to have you on the air with us.
I always miss you, Mark.
And good to have you here. Heber Brown, coming out in the midst of your dissertation and you're taking care of your flock and all the things that you do in the community. You took time to come out here today.
Thank you for the great opportunity, man. I appreciate it.
Always good to see you, Heber Brown, and Dr. Lawrence Brown, who is becoming a real mainstay on the Mark Steiner Show. And it's always great to have your deeply thoughtful ideas come forth on the airwaves.
Thank you. I really appreciate it and enjoyed this discussion.
Good to have you all with us. Thank you all for calling in. And bring in your ideas to the airwaves as well. We're going to take a little break. And on this day in 1980, did I have that day right? Yeah, 1980, the great Professor Longhair passed away. This is one of the songs that made him famous. This is New Orleans to its heart and soul. Big Chief, Professor Longhair. We'll be right back with the great Rebecca Hofberger talking about the American Visionary Art Museum. Stay with us.